Our guest on today's episode is Chris Combs, a name that is well known in the Tulsa music community. Chris is a musician and composer best known for his work with Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey and his current project, Combsy. Join us as we press play with Chris Combs.
Support for this podcast comes from Musicians Haven, a nonprofit organization focused on providing opportunities for musical enjoyment. Based out of Claremore, Musicians Haven provides events like jam nights, vinyl nights, and intimate concerts. More information on Musicians Haven at musichaven.org or at facebook.com/musicianshaveninc.
Thanks again for joining us on Press Play OK. Today we have multi-instrumentalist, composer, and Tulsa icon, Chris Combs, with us today. Chris, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so just let's start at the beginning. So on your Facebook page, I recently saw a picture of you, I mean, I'm taking a guess here, probably about 6 years old or so, holding a mandolin.
Right.
Looked like it was about the size of your body.
Right, right.
How long has music been a big part of your life?
Since day one. My dad plays guitar, and his whole side of the family are all musicians. They all sang, they all played. And so it's just always been there. My mom's side of the family is all from New Orleans. And my sisters and I are the first generation from that side that was born outside of New Orleans, you know, since like a long, long, long time ago. So there's a big kind of music love that kind of came with them from New Orleans, I think, you know, because it's just music is a part of people's daily lives there in a way that's maybe unique. But yeah, really from the very beginning. And I kind of got like, you know, my dad's side of the family were into like old like country gospel and kind of like as a kid what I thought was like hillbilly music or something. And then my mom's side of the family was all like jazz and like old school jazz stuff. So that's kind of the genesis of what, you know, what I remember my childhood being like musically.
You mentioned these kind of, I don't know if I'd call them conflicting, but they're definitely two different worlds of mm-hmm. music. You've got country gospel, you've got jazzy, you know, maybe more on the funky side of things.
Right, right.
At what point did you say, I'm more influenced by the jazz? Or at what point were you drawn more one way or the other?
You know, kind of from the beginning, I think I gravitated more towards the, like, you know, hip-hop side of things, I think, in terms of what my, like, childhood music was. Like, I loved Michael Jackson. I loved, like, MC Hammer and, like, some of the, like, stuff that was, like, breaking through to, like, a white kid in Tulsa in 1992 or whatever, you know, like. But that's, like, the stuff that I really loved. And so I feel like that, I remember, like, coming across the Dr. Dre stuff in like 94 or something. I was really young, like fourth or fifth grade or something. And my dad hearing it and being like, that's P-Funk, you know, because it's all like George Clinton samples and stuff. So I feel like there was like kind of an early, I don't really know why, but just kind of like went to that side of things. And, you know, there was also a lot of Garth Brooks in our house, you know, so I feel like the country thing's always been there. You know, we were in Tulsa.
The Garth Brooks side of it, though, listening to that style early on, did that influence you musically? So I guess, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, you play slide guitar.
Right, right.
Which isn't super common in jazz. Did the other side of it maybe give you a little bit of a different perspective on your songwriting?
I think so. I think so. There's a lot of like these musics that don't look like they have a lot in common actually have a lot of things in common, you know, and I feel like that, you know, it was all kind of like part of the, went into the mix.
So your current project is called Combsy. You mm-hmm. brought up hip hop and you brought up these kind of different sounds. And I think that Combsy is, it's definitely a blend of a lot of different sounds. And you may work with a rapper on one song and you may go kind of experimental jazzy on another song. I tried and I really couldn't come up with a good description for how it sounds. How do you describe it? How do you describe your sound?
I try my best to not describe it, I think. It really is like, it kind of started as a project to kind of do everything under one, you know, kind of explore these like gray areas essentially where it's not this or that, but it's both. And, you know, that was kind of like the genesis of the first record was like, find all these areas that are like equal parts, these two, like things. So yeah, man, that's a hard one.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess that probably just illustrates what you're going for, maybe? Is it just, yeah, you know, what feels good to you? How do you...
I think so. Part of it is, like, we are documenting a process, and it feels like our identity as a band has formed within the last, 8 months. You know, the last year and a half, we've been working on this, our next record that'll be coming out, early summer 2021. And we started recording that last January down at Sonic Ranch, this amazing studio in Texas. So it feels like we've been moving towards this point. And it's an interesting place right now because everyone's heard all of these things that have been pieces to the puzzle, but no one has seen the puzzle yet. You know, I don't know if that makes sense, but we're not playing any of it for anybody yet. So it's kind of fun. It's an interesting place right now because I feel like I can answer that question by playing you the record that we're working on, but that won't happen for another 6 months or something, probably.
You can't speed it up just a little bit.
Give us a little preview.
Right. But that's kind of part of it's what's been fun to explore with this project. You know, it's like we've got a variety of singles and things that are just like, you know, if there weren't labels attached and if you were free from whatever, like, what would you do? And this is kind of like a documentation of that. You know, we've got the full-length record that's all instrumental. We've got singles with singers. We've got, you know, singles with rappers. And, you know, I think we'll keep, like, Tulsa and, like, Oklahoma in general is such a, like, thriving art, like, and it's such a moment right now, too. Like, I think we'll probably just keep reacting and changing along with it, you know. So
you mentioned kind of finding your identity in the last year or so. And when you started, if you listen to that first album, which is from 2016, 17?
17, yeah.
Okay. So if you listen to that album, it's pretty much all instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the songs that you've really released since then have had a vocal element to them.
Right.
Like you said, whether it was a rapper like First Verse or Mike D or Olivia McGraw.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference? What's the biggest difference, in your opinion or in your experience, between composing instrumental music and vocal music?
I like the challenges that vocal music presents, being that what my safe place is to hide behind, you know, not hide behind anything, but stand behind the instruments and let this more impressionistic thing where you can let it be its own without telling people what it is, or even for yourself maybe having to decide what this actual thing is. So feel like with the vocal element in the mix, you kind of have to evolve your process a little bit, and you have to everything has to be in focus. Everything I don't know. I think there's more of a distinctly communicative element to it, to where we want to serve the message opposed to, you know, here's a song about a general thing or something that stemmed from an exercise or something like that, you know.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept. So you're not leaving as much up to the individual interpretation of the listener. You're actually telling them how to receive it.
Well, I think when lyrics are done right, that all of that is still there. There is still personal interpretation, and that's the actual. I feel like, you know, as artists, we bring 50% of the experience, and the rest of it is brought by, you know, the listener completing that circle. So I feel like within well-written lyrics and with any story, there's enough to dig in and kind of create your own, choose your own adventure almost. But it is I feel strangely as a composer more exposed with the vocal stuff. I don't know if that, there's something within that kind of twist there that doesn't allow me to hide behind impressionism, if that makes sense. Like, I like being challenged to actually say a thing.
Is the next record going to kind of follow the trends that you've had? Is it going to be more vocally driven?
It is all vocals. There's vocals on everything. Yeah, and we're working with Costa Upson, who is a singer, composer, writer, producer from Tulsa, and has been one of my best friends and kind of like secret collaborators. I mean, he's kind of worked on everything that I've worked on. It's kind of how it feels. But he produced Race Riot Suite for Jacob Fred. He's worked on a bunch of really big and fantastic projects. So we've been kind of co-writing this next record, and it's really exciting.
Well, I'm excited to check it out. You said February, maybe somewhere around there?
Early summer. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned Jacob Fred. Let's dive back into that a little bit. So you joined Jacob Fred in 2009?
Uh-huh. Full-time, yeah. I did some kind of patchwork fill-in kind of dates in 2008, but...
So that was around that time the band was really at the height of its success. What was it like jumping straight into all that momentum? Like, from what I've read, your first show was a sellout in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was it like jumping straight into all that momentum that you guys had?
Personally, for me, it was wildly crazy. I was super, super green. I'd never been on tour. I mean, I've done tours before where we're doing a week in Colorado and back or something, but I'd never done a real tour. Yeah, and they were my favorite band. I saw them for the first time in 2001 at Mayfest, and I just, I'd been a huge, huge Jacob Fred fan and had come to know the guys in the band through being a fan and going to the jam sessions and just trying to be around the, getting closer to the vibration of the center of the thing,
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's very bizarre, it was a very out of mind experience. Kind of smashed my worldview, and it was then rebuilt slowly,
So how so? What was broken by that was replaced with some other worldview?
I don't know if anything was replaced necessarily, but before that, I had been to New Orleans a bunch, to Colorado, and to Disney World with my parents as a kid. So I'd I had traveled, but not spending 6 weeks in a van going from city to city, and at the time, they were, doing Boston, Manhattan. I mean, and that's how my whole experience with the band was we stepped right into playing really great clubs in major markets, and for me, it was just a total trip. Like I said, still kind of processing a lot of the stuff we got to do in that time. Super grateful for the experiences and that, they really gave me an opportunity to find myself, and I was given kind of time to mess up and recorrect, and was given the opportunity to write, was given the opportunity to travel, and yeah, it was really, really wild. And I've been friends with Josh Raymer, who's the drummer, since high school. We've been playing together for 20 something years at this point, and he was the drummer in the band at the time. And I think only because of that, I kind of got a call, because I was teaching lessons, and I don't even know if I was in a band at the time. I'd played with Brian and Reed a bunch at local jam sessions and stuff, but yeah, I kind of just dropped out of nowhere. It's wild.
Well, I think it's really interesting you mention that, because you're talking about this band who tours nationally and they sell out venues all over the country, and they're signed to a major label, but they're playing these local jam sessions. From your experience in the band, what was different about that band that allowed you to have still that local connection after making it nationally, being known nationally?
That was all through just personal choices that Brian and Reed made. Because at the time, I'm 10 years younger than them, so they had really, by 2005 or something, they were playing all of the biggest jazz festivals in the world and doing all this crazy stuff. and really like weren't necessarily in Tulsa. Like they were on the road constantly. And then I think 2006 or 2007, they started having like staying in town and hosting jam sessions. And I just thought that was amazing because it's like when you're a successful band, like it's easier to be, at least within the jazz thing, like I'll just say like, it's almost easier to be impressed by people when they're doing the work out and away from town. And it's like, oh, it looks glamorous and it looks great. And so for them to come back and do something like in the hometown and it's, you know, demystified and you're just seeing somebody play piano or bass or drums, like it was amazing because it kind of like offered us the olive branch of like, you guys can all do this too. And it also like showed us it's like, is like demystifying in a really inspiring way because you're not hiding behind anything. You're just watching someone play. And yeah, it's kind of easy for bands. I think when things are going really well, it's easy to almost hide behind hype, you know, or excitement, you know, because people overlook all kinds of stuff when they're excited. And so it's very cool to see them come back and be like, do these kind of like shows that weren't super promoted. And it was more about like actively reconnecting with the music scene in Tulsa. And I think that honestly like laid some very cool genetics for the rest of us in terms of like moving forward, because everyone now, like I don't know a nationally or internationally touring band that lives in Tulsa that isn't part of the scene. There's examples out there, but like everyone is now like, and I, part of that is Tulsa maybe having a slightly more national presence, but it just seems like there's not like the disconnect that at least I perceived, you know, 20 years, 15 years ago.
Like you said, yeah, Tulsa is, I mean, the music community, everybody knows each other. Everybody that I've, not everybody, but a lot of people that I've experienced in the music scene, they're all just, they're happy to talk with you. They're happy to work with you. The, hey, let's play a show together sometime, or let's jam together sometime. That's just so common whenever you're working with musicians. But also, you know, if you think of the history of jazz, so many of those artists got together after shows and they played jam sessions together and they built something just working together. Do you think maybe did that also have a little bit of an influence on the way that you all interacted with your community?
I think so. Yeah.
So looking at other jazz artists that maybe you played alongside with at these festivals or who came out to see you when you were out on tour, is that still a thing in the jazz community? Did you ever like sit up at 2 a.m. playing with these other jazz artists after a set at a club or anything like that?
Yes. But a lot of it wouldn't be like how you would imagine almost like a smoky late night thing. It was more like these crazy late night jazz fest gigs. You know what I mean? Like New Orleans Jazz Fest is like, it's still like, I mean, it's like super hype, but it's like the spirit of New Orleans in the 20s is there, you know. It is 20, like when it's really, you know, it didn't happen this year, of course, last year or this year, but, you know, there's a big festival, but outside of the festival, the entire city is taken over by like musicians from all over the country and the biggest music fans. So there's literally like 24 hours of music for like 14 days, you know, where there's breakfast sets, there's 4 a.m. sets, there's, you know, just goes, and, you know, something about that 3, 4 a.m. area, like that's where stuff really starts getting weird, experimental, strange, you know, and so there's been a lot of moments of like looking around and be like, whoa, like this dude from Prince's band and this dude from blah, 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 and Chris Daddy Day was here earlier, and like these crazy amount of musicians, like all in one place, on stage at different times, you know. So that's been kind of, so that spirit is very much alive, I think, especially in New Orleans.
Well, I know it at 3 or 4 a.m., I'm not going to say I'm the most creative, but I'm definitely the weirdest that I can be. Let's talk a little bit about jazz, a little more about the genre. You know, I think jazz as a genre is something that so many people have a strong opinion on, but I don't feel like a lot of people really know a lot about it. You know, it's like they hear the word jazz and they're either like, you know, oh, that's just sophisticated people music, or ew, that's boring, or, you know, like they have these strong opinions that are based on maybe cliches or, you know, outdated ideas. What's it like to play in a jazz band right now, or to play music that could be considered jazz? I mean, do you think that gives you any extra barriers, or do you think that is a, you know, a positive thing right now?
I would say as a band, you know, because I've got like, I do a lot of trio work in Tulsa as well, which is like slightly more, to me is like slightly more, like we're actually playing standards or we're playing like original compositions that are played like standards or something. In a lot of ways right now, the style that my personal stuff plays, which this is like touching on the larger issue here, like there's people that I, you know, would probably say that I'm not a jazz, that what we're doing is not jazz at all, you know? And that's like, I think the core of the issue is that jazz itself is this like really divisive concept. You know, when you think about rock and roll or like rocking or like when you rock together, like it's such a unifying thing. Like, you know, you see like in your imagination, at least I see like the fists in the air and the ball, everything that goes along with rock and roll. And then jazz, it's like you, as soon as you say the word, there's like 10 people in the room with 10 different opinions. And, you know, half of them are saying the other half aren't jazzers because of blah, 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 blah. You know, and it's like, it's been institutionalized in a way that's really kind of gross to me. And in, like, as a concept, like capital J jazz in 2020 is like a super bummer, you know. But I love that people are carrying on the tradition. I just think that it should be called something else or like, I don't know. I'm a big fan of like Nicholas Payton's take on Black American music that we're actually dealing with a much larger thing, that jazz died. And like, he's got like an actual date, like 1958 or something when this album, I can't remember what the actual, but Nick, yeah, if you're not like checking out Nicholas Payton's stuff, it's very, very fascinating. But yeah, all that, you know, I feel like that there's a lot to unpack with jazz in America. Outside of all that, like being like everything that we play, like a lot of it is jazz genetics and dialect. But almost everything is like a beat or like some kind of groovaceous element happening in it. And I feel like that today is more well received than it was in like 2010. And, you know, my perception of that is that it's largely entirely due to Kendrick Lamar, Thundercat, and these like hip hop artists that are making the most important music in America right now and then using live bands. And like Terrace Martin, who produced To Pimp a Butterfly, is like an amazing saxophonist and is bringing this like jazz language into the hip hop world, where it's like most relevant and makes the most sense. And that's kind of my, so I think, you know, the jazz concept itself is really confusing. And I kind of like, well, the first thing I want to say is like, I'm not a jazz guy, like just to protect myself from the jazz guys or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. Things are changing and moving in a good way, I think.
Well, I think it's funny that we have to put those, like, you know, you have to define that before somebody else creates an opinion about you just because of a genre.
Right.
You know, I think it's interesting. And that's kind of going back to my original point is like, you know, people have these strong opinions about a genre, even though it's not just one singular thing. It has so much to it.
And it's one of those things, too. I feel like they're, for me personally, like, is this kind of funny Zen thing happening where, like, the further people get from trying, like, in, like, the Yoda try, you know, like, the further you, because, like, yeah, the further you get from people that are, like, really trying to play jazz, the more pure it becomes, you know, like, and the more jazz it actually becomes. So there's this weird thing that's happening right now. And there's a lot of, like, amazing, brilliant artists that are, like, would consider themselves full-on jazz artists, and that's, I don't want to take anything away from that, but yeah, it's an interesting conversation.
Let's continue on with that line of thought. So you mentioned hip hop and you mentioned the groove that goes along with jazz. Obviously that's, you brought up Kendrick Lamar, Thundercat, you know, all of these artists who are really taking more of the hip hop lean to it, but with such strong and clear jazz influences.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always kind of been around in hip hop. What is the connection that you see between hip hop and jazz, and how does that work?
I see it as just one music. I think it's, I like, that's what I love about Nicholas Payton's take on that there is this thread of Black American music that is like, depending on how you look at it, is classical, is jazz, is rap, is whatever. But I do feel like, you know, it's they're at their purest and best forms, it's folk music, you know. It's music that is not, that is speaking purely and speaking without the influence of institution. And then in addition to that, there's like a lot of musical elements that remain, like being like, it swings, it feels good, it's socially relevant, it can be challenging politically, it can be party music, it can be like all of these they've inhibited these same places in American culture. And then there's a lot of like distinct on paper like handoffs where it's like, you know, like Tribe Called Quest using Ron Carter on, you know, Low End Theory, you know, and like so much of the foundations of hip hop being samples taken from, you know, the jazz era and also from, you know, like soul and funk that evolved through the 60s that was also using jazz language, you know, where you're hearing like the Isaac Hayes stuff from late 60s, early 70s is amazing. It's like all of this deep jazz verbology, but within like framed with an orchestra. I feel like there's a lot of parallels, of course, but it seems like an evolution of the singular thing. The attitude behind Ellington and Mingus is alive to me and Kendrick and like Tyler the Creator, you know, where there's people out there like mixing it up and furthering the conversation and entertaining and challenging us. Yeah.
Hand you the manual while I gear shift. Call me what you want, but they gon' call me a lyricist. Cause I take it all counts, guilty, serious. And they couldn't really tell you how we built these pyramids. Can't miss it though, like you looking for it, here it is. Since a kid, like it was bottles of the serum in the crib. Say something slick, probably wouldn't hear them if they did. What's a subliminal dart to a spear up in the rib?
Kind of connecting that to some work you're doing recently, you've been working with the people from Fire in Little Africa, which is a documentary and an album inspired by Black Wall Street and the race massacre. How did you get involved with that?
I've worked with a few of the artists that are included in the organization. I've played with Verse for years, on and off. I've worked with Steph and King Cut and a few other. So, you know, we've got like old friendships that have kind of tied in, but really are like, within the Combsy world, we've been doing these live shows, and that's been a lot of fun. Fire Fridays. That's been kind of like our, you know, kind of official interaction with a lot of those artists. We've met, you know, a lot of like MCs and singers that we hadn't met before.
So this isn't the first time that you've done music that kind of revolves around the Tulsa Race Massacre. So back in 2011, you composed the Race Riot Suite with Jacob Fred, and essentially this is an album kind of telling the story of the Tulsa Race Massacre through music. What draws you to write about the Tulsa Race Massacre?
At the time, it was like pure, I think, shock was the initial reaction, because I hadn't, you know, kind of classic story, hadn't heard about it. Growing up, didn't learn about an Oklahoma history class, you know, and then had heard like here and there that there was a race riot, you know, quote unquote. And then as I started investigating, you know, learned that like Greenwood was a thriving community and that Black Wall Street was one of the most powerful African-American districts in the country, and that the music scene was super vibrant and that the social scene was super vibrant and that the dollar turned around, you know, it didn't leave their community, you know? So all of that, like, I didn't know, and would kind of learn a thing at a time, write a little piece of music, and it was written slowly over 2 years or so. But yeah, it was kind of like, it didn't come from a place of like, I'm going to write, like, here's the concept, I'm going to write all these pieces about the thing. It kind of like, there were a lot of pieces laying around that kind of came together. But for me, it was like dealing with the shock of learning about it and like just kind of the exterior situational trauma of knowing that this thing happened and that it had been actively covered up, and that a lot of the same family and like money is still in Tulsa, and that we're still dealing with like institutional issues and all this stuff that is like just feels a little too similar, you know, 100 years later. But yeah, just kind of a love for my city and community, and then trying to work through that as an artist.
Well, I think it goes without saying, but I think it's amazing how much more willing we are to talk about it these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just going back to 2011 when you put this out, like you said, it wasn't being taught, it wasn't being talked about. You didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's insane how different it was back then in regards to people's attitudes towards it.
Right.
So, you mentioned the new album. You've been working on that. Apart from just that next step, what's the future for your music? Where you want your music to go moving forward?
Man, I don't ever want music to do anything. And I think that's kind of part of the interaction with it that is rewarding for me. And it sounds kind of corny, but like, I feel like a big part of my relationship with creativity is letting it tell me what to do. And so that's kind of like the journey that we've been on this last year and a half or so that we've been writing and recording the new record is like, it's like where we're at now, like I couldn't have imagined. And it really is more exciting than what I would have imagined. And I'm so glad that I didn't come to it with a framework and say like, here's the terrarium that you have to live inside. And then like something breaks through and it's like, oh, better trim that back because that's not part of the original concept or whatever. So I don't really know. I hope it keeps surprising me. You know, like we have a really great crew of creative people kind of working together. And I feel like we're in a good place to just kind of wonder for a little bit longer, you know?
Well, that's cool. Chris, thank you so much for talking with us today. Chris Combs of Combsy, Jacob Fred, and the Chris Combs Trio. Chris, thanks for talking with us today and being here on Press Play OK.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for hanging out with us today on Press Play OK. And once again, thank you to Chris for talking with us. All the songs you heard on today's podcast were Combsy. You can check Combsy out through Horton Records on Spotify and, of course, in rotation on RSE Radio. Press Play OK is a part of the RSE Radio Podcasting Network, created on the campus of Rogers State University in Claremore, Oklahoma. Thanks again to Musicians Haven for making this podcast possible. Now let's close it out with a little bit more from Combsy.